Blog Talk Radio.
Interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
Welcome, friends. Brothers and sisters, Jesus Christ, and seekers of the truth. But whoever you are, I know the thing that we all have in common. Don't we all want to know the truth? The truth about what's really going on here in this crazy, crazy world. So welcome to the 574th edition of SDG. And the title of this message is Game Update for 38. And later in this message, folks, we're going to tie it all into Building Upon the Rock, also known the Cornerstone, also known as Jesus Christ. Now, the Bible says in Ephesians chapter 2, verse 20, that together we are his house, built upon the foundation of the apostles and the prophets, and the cornerstone, which is Jesus Christ himself. So stay tuned to learn how we must build upon this cornerstone, which is square, level, and plumb, or else anything we build will fail and eventually fall. Folks, saying anything and everything. And isn't this exactly what we're seeing today? Aren't all of our institutions failing and falling? From our churches to our schools, from our banks to our businesses, and don't even get me started on our government and medical system. But folks, as always, the bottom line is that as believers, we may be in this world, but we're not of this world. We're just God's people. What are we doing, folks? We're simply passing through. So be sure to stay tuned to find out the latest news that the mainstream media will never tell you, the forbidden news, as we dive deeper and deeper into America through 9 events which are unfolding in slow motion while on steroids. But remember, folks, it all got started with that lab-engineered, media-manipulated coronavirus heist. And as we do every week, folks, let's go back to something from last week. Now, last week, we heard from a mama bear out in California who blasted her local school board for sponsoring a family-friendly drag show. I mean, isn't that an oxymoron? A family-friendly drag show? I mean, think about back when they used to do public executions in England. Would you call it a family-friendly execution? How about today on death row? Would you call that a family-friendly execution if you were there to witness it? I mean, come on. Makes no sense. But let's just have a re-listen to the mama bear who was really ranting against these drag shows, and she let them have it.
I just want to know what it is that makes a drag show family friendly. Because if you follow it to its logical conclusion, you can slap family friendly titles on anything. You can have family friendly gentlemen's clubs, family friendly strip shows, family friendly 50 Shades of Grey read aloud. Will you approve my flyer if I want to host in all the sex secrets of the Kama Sutra for kids and families if it's family friendly? Mm-hmm. My question.
Wow.
What is it about a grown man, and I honestly, sincerely, as a woman, mean this. What is it about a grown man costumed in a sparkly bra with augmented boobs busting out, a leather miniskirt barely covering his twerking ass with tuck tape on his front while spreading his fishnetted legs as he writhes on the ground, grinding his groin next to a minor? Family-friendly.
Right.
You owe us an answer.
No.
And you know, you don't get to hide by just taking something down off Peachtree and calling it a day. You owe an explanation
right.
And an apology.
Right.
Listen, you all got caught with your sparkly panties down. And while we have a culture that has a massive problem with child porn, with sex trafficking, you, a little school district, board of adults, made the decision to feature an event to hypersexualize young children. Do you want to know that the word that defines that? It's groomer. Right. You all played the activist pimp for an Align surgical center and for a 21-plus gay bar. It makes you groomers and activist pimps, and we won't have those sitting on a school board who oversees the education of our children. You all stepped out of line. You should be ashamed.
Yep.
There is nothing loving.
No.
There is nothing but to unite and include, because the logical conclusion of that is you end up in diabolical evil. There are boundaries, and you don't slap family-friendly titles on stuff to cover your ass.
Said it well, didn't she? And this needs to be happening all across America if we're going to stop it. And I'm going to get into that a little bit more in the Kabuki Theater update. And here's a resource that I mentioned last week and I promised I would share with you. It's titled A Parent's Guide to Radical Gender Theory. It's written by Christopher F. Rufo and Michael Young. Now, you can get this out at ChristopherRufo.com. Just go to his website. And if you can't find it, email me at kdbeer1961@gmail.com. And Christopher tells us, or teaches in this 11-page, very well-presented document, what radical gender theory actually is. And it's essentially a catch-all term for academic queer theory. And these aren't my words. These are the words used by these people, like Kimberly Crenshaw, who we're going to talk about a little later in Back to the Future. So this is the catch-all term for their academic queer theory, transgender ideology, and gender identity activism. Now, the premises of their ideology, which is really stinking thinking, is that sex and gender are a socially constructed concept, and they're not based upon reality. They are merely human inventions and used as instruments of power. I mean, can you believe this absurdity? So they are not really object reality. That's what they're saying. So a man isn't necessarily a man, and a woman isn't necessarily a woman. I mean, can it get any more stupid than that, folks? So this radical gender theory and the theorists behind it argue that white European men invented the gender binary or division between man and woman. And why? In order to oppress racial and sexual minorities. I mean, it can't get any more stupid than this, folks. They believe that this system is what's known as heteronormativity, and it must be exposed and critiqued and deconstructed. Now, why would they want to do this? Well, they're doing it because it's the neo-Marxist methodology to destroy society. And why? In order to usher in a world beyond the norms of heterosexual middle-class society. Oh, and by the way, another one of the Marxist ideologies is known as intersectionality. And I learned that term from a conversation I had with my pastor, Pastor Todd. And I wanted to share it with you in the Back to the Future section today. So just stay tuned for that, folks. And I hope it wakes more and more of us up doing the same thing, only from a slightly different angle. But like I said, more on that in the Back to the Future section. So right now, in order to facilitate the deconstruction of this system of Western civilization, the radical gender activists promote what they call synthetic sexual identities. And some of these are, you've probably heard the terms now. I never knew what they meant until maybe a year or two ago. Pansexual, genderqueer, two-spirit. And they also use what are known as neo-pronouns or new pronouns. I've heard people, instead of referring to them as he or she, they'll say things like Z, Zim, and Zer. I mean, it's just almost like a stupid video game or those old Dungeons and Dragons games where you're out of reality, you know? Well, the goal here is to replace the abject reality of biological sex. And remember, we covered what C.S. Lewis had to say about sex and gender. You know, the male-female binary reality and the consequent nuclear family that is built around it. You know, God established man and woman. God established family. Then God established government. And ultimately, God established the church. But what these people are arguing for, what they call queer alternatives, are beyond binaries. Some of the strains of academic queer theory also support, and this is what's really sick, eliminating prohibitions on child pornography. And a little more on that later in Kabuki Theater. They actually promote child sex. And you know what that's going to lead to ultimately? Pedophilia. And remember maybe a year ago we heard this really absurd, sick TED talk on pedos or pedophilia. And this speaker argues that we're a little too tough on the pedophiles. Let's have a listen.
I want to quickly summarize where we are at the moment. According to current research, pedophilia is an unchangeable sexual orientation, just like, for example, heterosexuality. No one chooses to be a pedophile. No one can cease being one. The difference between pedophilia and other sexual orientations is that living out this sexual orientation will end in a disaster. Right now, most of us feel discomfort when we think about this scenario. And most of us feel discomfort when we think about pedophiles. But just like pedophiles, we are not responsible for our feelings. We do not choose them. But we are responsible for our actions. And we must make a decision. It is in our responsibility to reflect and to overcome our negative feelings about pedophiles and to treat them with the same respect we treat other people with. We should accept that pedophiles are people who have not chosen their sexuality and who, unlike most of us, will never be able to live it out freely if they want to lead an upright life. We should accept that pedophilia is a sexual preference, a thought, a feeling, and not an act. We should differentiate between child sexual abuse and pedophilia. We shouldn't increase the suffering of pedophiles by excluding them, by blaming and mocking them. By doing that, we increase their isolation and we increase the chance of child sexual abuse. Only if they make themselves recognizable because they're not afraid of punishment, of anger and rejection, can we better understand the causes of pedophilia and we can improve their treatment.
Folks, that is sick. What else can I say? So what can we do? Well, if you go back to Christopher Rufo and Michael Young's guide, a parent's guide to radical gender theory, and go to the end of it, you'll see that he gives you a list on how to get organized. And I'm just going to briefly bullet point them. First, he says, show up in your community. Go to school board meetings. Ask questions. Do it respectfully, folks. But you have that as a parent. And then get to know your school board members. All of them aren't bad. In fact, one of the people at our church, his wife is a school board member, and she was sharing some of the struggles she had during the whole COVID thing with mask mandates and all. He didn't want any, but she was working with her hands, and as the board was. You know, they were being threatened by the state of Pennsylvania and Governor Wolf that if they did not comply on simple thing, mask mandates, they were going to lose state funding. So a lot of these school board members aren't your enemy. They're on your side, but they're restrained, they're constrained. And we have to take this all the way up the political ladder to your state government where most of you are funding for schools. And then remember, so these state education programs are funded by the federal government. So get to know your school board. Then identify a specific goal, whatever it may be, and then build a leadership team. Get your people together. You know, get the people that know how to project manage and team build, and build upon this goal that you've set up. And then join grassroots networks of other parents. There's ones like Parents Defending Education, Moms for Liberty, Center for Renewing America, No Left Turn in Education, and Save Our Schools. And then you need to gather the evidence. So you have to do your research. And there are places where you can go to learn what the curriculum is, the budget, the training materials for your specific school and your school district in your state. And then make this issue as public as possible. Get on talk shows. Write editorials for your local paper. Attend meetings. Organize meetings. Remember, this is grassroots. Somebody that's going to represent your group and speak well.
And then make strong arguments, folks. Make sure you do your homework. Make sure you understand. And then you also have to know your opponent and never lose your cool. Because the first person that blows up is the one that's usually viewed as the nut or the wacko. And then you can also run for school board. Like Katie from my church. Get involved, and that's the point. But we have to keep moving. And right now, it's time for Sister Kathy and Brother Alex's Freaky Deaky News Update. And as we do each and every week, folks, let's get started. Coronavirus heist update. You know what, folks? It's starting up again here. I'm getting all the lag on my computer. The thing won't load. The thing won't move. And I bet you my audio is cracking up. This is so frustrating. I can't even tell you.
The coronavirus, COVID-19, bottle, pandemic, the coronavirus, it's a scandemic. They call it the great equalizer. And say we're all in this together, except that for the bankers, politicians, and powers to be. And folks, that ain't either you or me. So let's all wake up to the coronavirus heist and just say they know all their lies and minds control. Coronavirus, COVID-19, pandemic, the coronavirus, it's a scandemic. They call it the great equalizer and say we're all in this together.
It is a scamdemic, folks. It is not the great equalizer. We're going to have a few haves and a lot of have-nots. They are moving us into a modern feudal system, and that's what it's all about. Now, you know, as we start every week here, we do our SADS update, our sudden adult death update. And there's so many, and some of these stories are so sad. There was a very talented singer in a school production dropped dead during the performance. There's more football players, both on a high school and college level. I think there are even a few on the pro level. But the one I want to focus on today is the 63-year-old bodybuilding icon and author Doug Brignoli. Now, he's an icon in the bodybuilding world, and he's actually an inspiration. The guy's in shape, 63 years old. And he's got the body of a 30-year-old. He takes care of himself. So that in and of itself is an inspiration. Dead the other day. And, of course, the official report is the cause of death is unknown. Now, he strongly supported mandatory vaccinations for COVID. And his last statement on the subject is why I'm covering him today. And you may have heard all this already, but he said, I have enough confidence in the vaccine based on my research to get it done. Can you believe this, folks? And then he went on and said, and those of you who think the vaccine kills people can use me as a test. If I die, you were right. If I don't die and have no ill effects, you are wrong and should admit it, at least to yourselves. Better yet, you should admit you were misled and tell the world who misled you so other people can benefit from avoiding these fearmongers. You know how many times I was called a fearmonger, folks? You know how long I've been warning the listeners and everyone I know about the dangers of these mRNA vaccines. You know how many times? I mean, I've been blind. I've been called names. I've had sometimes I actually think somebody's going to jump into my face and punch me. I didn't mislead anyone. Everybody in this alt media movement who's speaking out against us, we didn't mislead anybody. Mr. Brignoli was the one misleading. Folks, the truth is that the death jab was never a vaccine by classical, plum, square, and level logic. But it did do its job. You know, Brignoli did not get COVID, nor did he die from COVID. He died from the quote-unquote vaccine. No one ever said you wouldn't die from the vaccine. They said the vaccine would prevent you from dying from COVID. In fact, more doctors beginning to say that very thing was from the Daily Skeptic. And it's covering Dr. Asim Malhotra a very well-known British cardiologist who once endorsed the vaccine on TV, but now he's raising awareness as to their dangers. And in a September two-part peer-reviewed analysis of vaccine efficacy published in the Journal of Insulin Resistance, Dr. Malhotra made the comment that I'm going to play in this new interview with James Freeman Wells. Now, Mr. Freeman Wells is a former head of the UK Trade and Business Inflation Statistics Office of National Statistics in the UK Government Statistics Agency. And he tweeted a link to his interview with Dr. Malhotra. And you can listen to it. If you're interested, just email me and I'll send you the whole interview. But what I'd like to do right now is just play this short little 33-second clip of Dr. Malhotra warning about the dangers of cardiac issues associated with this experimental mRNA jab.
It is my duty and responsibility as a consultant cardiologist and public health campaigner to urgently inform doctors, patients, and members of the public that the COVID mRNA vaccine has likely played a significant role or been a primary cause of unexpected cardiac arrests, heart attacks, strokes, cardiac arrhythmias, and heart failure since 2021 until proven otherwise.
Folks, I've been checking my speeds and I am very slow, so I moved over to my backup. I don't know if the audio is good. I want to give you a little update before we move on and make some comments on that. I have a new system here. We're working off a Mac and the old PC. I'm checking speeds. It looks like the PC doesn't actually work as well as the Mac in terms of connectivity and speeds. So I'll be moving over the entire system to the Mac. And, you know, for the life of me, I don't know if it's the fact that Windows 7 isn't supported anymore, but I have a lot of legacy programs and I have to stay on Windows 7 right now. But for whatever reason, I have very slow internet speeds there. So I'll do rest of the show on my backup system here, which is a little difficult. But you heard what he said there, didn't you, folks? Until proven otherwise, it is like RNA vaccines, and let's just call them death jabs, played a significant or primary role in all unexplained heart attacks, strokes, cardiac arrhythmias, and heart failure since 2021. And if that's not bad enough, folks, the renowned cardiologist here from the United States, Dr. Peter McCullough, who we've talked about for quite a long time now, Dr. McCullough is also out there now saying the exact same thing. So let's have a listen to Dr. Peter McCullough revealing the dangers of the COVID jab. This is an interview he did with on Breitbart, and it's just a couple clips. In fact, I took the intro, and then I jumped in around the 4 minute and 20 second part. So there's a little bit of a jump there, but I just wanted you to hear these essential points in this minute and a half clip.
I want to bring in Dr. Peter McCullough. Dr. McCullough, we only got a minute here. I'll hold you through the break. Tell our audience, particularly the podcast radio audience, that was incredibly powerful. What did we just see there?
We just saw a montage implicating, I think clearly demonstrating that the COVID-19 vaccines, actually all of them, cause myocarditis or heart inflammation, and it's fatal. It's fatal. This is a fatal complication, and these products are still in use. America is outraged. Colleagues from Germany taking biopsies of hearts of people who have myocarditis finds the spike protein in the heart. So it's there, it's present and accounted for. There now are 200 papers, Steve, showing that the myocarditis causes heart damage and a scar, and then the scar becomes the basis for a cardiac arrhythmia. And then the arrhythmia is responsible for the sudden death that we're seeing. And we're seeing sudden death now on a massive scale in younger people. And it's my view that it's the COVID-19 vaccine until proven otherwise. If a healthy person suddenly dies and there's no antecedent disease, it's the vaccine until proven otherwise. Now, it can easily be ruled out if the family comes forward and tells America they didn't take the vaccine. Fine, we rule out the vaccine. Otherwise, I think the operating assumption should be that it is the vaccine. That's a conservative regulatory approach. The majority of adult Americans have taken the vaccine.
What? What? Are you serious? Are you serious? Can I have some more coffee?
Oh, that's right, Paul. I'm serious. Dr. Peter McCullough is serious. Dr. Asim Malhotra from the UK. And there are thousands of other doctors now speaking out. Now, think about it. When the top cardiologist in the U.S., Dr. Peter McCullough, who first was we first talked about him, what, a year ago? A year and a half ago? Is it stating the obvious? And the obvious is that COVID jabs are killing people? Come on. You have to start asking yourself what's going on. And just this week, in a 15-0 decision, the FDA decided to make child COVID jabs. The children don't even die from this, folks. Yet they're dying from the jabs. They're agreeing to make it part of the vaccination schedule for children to attend school. Now, a lot of governors have already come out and said this will not happen in our state. And that's why you need to get involved. Like we talked about in the update at the beginning of the show, get out there and get involved. Get involved with your school boards. Get that guide. And you can apply it to other things than just the gender dysphoria and all the radical gender theory. Get that and get involved. Get Christopher Rufo's PDF. Study up and then get involved. These are your children, folks, and you are responsible for them. Now, we've all heard about the drag queen story hours in the local libraries and the family-friendly drag shows and everything else. And it's strange, folks. It's really nuts. And what I'd like to do, and it's all tied together, too, but what I'd like to do is cover some of that in our next segment, the Kabuki Theater Update.
COVID-19, George Floyd, Rice, BLM, police reform, the 2020 election. All merely coincidence? I hardly think so. Folks, it's called Kabuki Theater. In Japanese, Ka means salt. Bu means dance. Ki means skill from the verb. Kabu meaning to slam or display. Folks, it's all a lie. It's the flattened curve. The curvy of economy, stupid, must slow down the velocity of money. Or it'll hyperinflate before we're done. Stealing it all. Trump, bad. Must go. Good is bad. Bad is good. Up is down. Light is dark. It's all Kabuki Theater, folks. Prepping the masses for Agenda 2030 and the new world. Just say no to it all and wake up before it's too late.
Theater, folks. You know, these drag queen story hours at our local libraries and family-friendly drag shows in our tax-funded schools, let's be honest, what is it? It's grooming. And it's not reality. It's building upon a cornerstone that isn't level, plumb, or square. And this mom here said it so very well. And I'd like she's addressing this whole concept of trans women being moms. And just listen to her, because in less than a minute, she sums it up so very, very well.
Ulta Beauty is now Ulta Delusional. You know, did you ever think you'd see the day where beauty brands would create a podcast with two biological males talking about girlhood? It's essentially two males mansplaining what it means to be a woman. You know, beauty could be for anyone, sure, but girlhood is for girls. Girlhood is not just a product that you can purchase at the makeup store. You know, my biggest issue with this is these two men talking about how they want to be a mom one day and that they absolutely can be. No, you absolutely cannot be and never will be a mother. Renting the womb of another woman will never make you a mother yourself. Not even adopting will make you a mother. You know why? Because you are a man. 99 things a man can be and a mom isn't one of them. Women are not a fetish. We are not gender-affirming tools for males that want to feel more feminine. We are more than a dress and some pretty eyeshadow, and the fact that we have to keep reminding men of that is pretty dang sad. So maybe stop erasing women and treating us like caricatures to be mocked. Thanks.
Very well said, amen. You know, there's no way anyone can transform their biological makeup. And all of this queer gender ideology is not based upon a square, level, and plumb cornerstone necessary to build any stable system, any stable society, anything that's going to last. Folks, they're out here to kill, steal, and destroy. And that's the hard truth. Prager said, if there is any hill worth dying on, it is on the hill of objective truth. And truth is square, plumb, and level, folks. And the truth, the chief cornerstone, the rock upon which all reality is built, is Jesus Christ. Now, Voltaire, he's a twisted philosopher from many years ago, said those who can make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities. And isn't that what's going on right now? So first they get you to believe that the world is non-binary, and they can have 50, 100 different genders. And then it gets you to promote genital mutilation. Didn't we have that out there with the Muslims a few years back? The girls in that culture get genitally mutilated. And today we have Americans doing it to their young boys and girls. Those who can make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities. But guess what's up next, folks? It's even going beyond this. There's an article out in the American Mind titled, Why Can't Johnny Read Porn? So the author starts off saying, having normalized sex outside of marriage, which we did through the sitcoms and basic decay of culture, you know, the music, the movies, and cohabitation is just so normal now. And now we have same-sex sex and same-sex marriage, and now we are into this transgender ideology. Well, there's something more beyond this, and the left's next target is to sexualize children. And they're using several mechanisms to do this. They use the public libraries, the public schools, the book retailers, and they're forcing all of them to start to feature these gender-bending books. And we're going to get into more of that a little bit later in the Absurdian Report concerning gender-bending books. But these are being targeted at ever younger children, all with the aim of mainstreaming what's perverted, mainstreaming the fringe, so to speak. Now, in Pride Month last June, there was drag shows featured openly in the presence of young children. And you've seen videos of this, you've heard about it, where these nude men dressed as sexualized women had little children present as they twerked and as they exposed their genitalia and as they had these young innocent children put dollar bills in their panties. I mean, this is sick, folks. Now, the activists and the academics who embrace this Marxist ideology are hard at work at redefining pedophiles. And we played that clip here in the opening from the TED Talk. Now, these pedophiles are being relabeled or rebranded minor attracted persons. And why? Well, they do that to reduce the stigma associated with desire to have sex with children. And folks, this is sick. Now, these sickos even admit that. Now, they also admit that much work must be done before these practices become tolerated in America. Now, the academics invented and defend new practices in these seemingly obscure journals with all of these technical words, like instead of calling them a pedophile or a pedo, they call them minor attracted persons. Well, the academics like to do this sort of thing. And I just lost my power, folks. Don't know what that's all about. But I think I'm still on. Yeah, it looks like I'm still on. That was really strange. Very strange. Well, praise the Lord for that, folks. We didn't lose the hookup. And I don't know what that was all about. But back to, kind of lost my train of thought. I have to get recentered here. Anyways, what they do is they take these academic journals and they put all kinds of group speak and big words, and they use mental gymnastics to take these deviant practices and translate them into methods and practices for our teaching colleges. And then after that, they're unveiled in our taxpayer-funded classrooms and libraries, and even maybe at the local parade in your town or the band, you know, the band shell down at your park. Now, the author of this article, James Lindsay, tells how drag went from the fringes to the mainstream. And he said it's by using these academic studies. For example, there's one by Harper Keenan, and it's titled Little Miss Hot Mess. And then it's subtitled Drag Pedagogy, Playful Practice of Queer Imagination in Early Childhood. Can you believe this stuff, folks? Now, this is still underdeveloped. And I'm going to tell you this, they're building upon an out of square, out of plumb, out of level collection of stinking thinking and posting it as academic work. Pedagogy was published in
Curriculum Inquiry. This is a respected journal in the education realm, and I want to quote something out of it. Introducing drag into schools and library story times, argues Keenan and Hot Mess, will unsettle binary gender expectations among children. So basically what you want to do is knock the children off the rock of truth, the cornerstone, which is square, plumb, and level. And then I want to continue. And suddenly, omnipresent drag queen story hours create space for young children and families to immerse themselves in LGBT themed stories and a pathway into imaginative, messy, and rule-breaking aspects of drag for children without necessity for watering down queer cultures. I mean, folks, this would almost sound like a something should be on the Babylon Bee, except it's not. It's true. So among the next mechanism to be normalized in this deconstruction of decency, porn, what they're calling porn literacy. Folks, did you know that Planned Parenthood and the government funders behind it are already promoting porn literacy to the school trainers and public health officials? What's normal about this? What's healthy about this? Why is this necessary? Folks, I'm telling you, it's already very late in the game, yet few people even know what this term porn literacy actually means. Now, just as they did with the drag queen story hour and the drag-friendly, the family-friendly drag shows, these pseudo-academic articles are showing what's at stake for porn literacy. Kathy Albury's 2014 article published in Porn Studies is titled Porn and Sex Education, Porn as Sex Education. And it's one of the most widely cited porn literacy articles today. But back when the author, James Lindsay, first read it several years ago, and he's been studying this for years, it only had four citations. But today, Albury's classic, if you want to use that term, classic sickness, has over 116 citations. It's been cited that many times. Now, anytime you're in any kind of academic endeavor, whether it's writing patents or writing articles, the way you can tell whether your particular contribution has been effective or not is how many times it's cited. So if I look at one of the patents I wrote and it's only been cited once or twice, it's not very broad in its impact in that particular realm. On the other hand, if it's cited 100 times or more, it's a significant technology. Well, the same thing applies here to this stinking thinking. So with 116 citations, that thing, that article, that sick article is getting some traction. Now, folks, remember, we did an entire SDG episode on porn and the Zionistic connection. And I know every time I bring up Zionism, people confuse it with Jewry, called an anti-Semite, but that's not what I'm talking about, folks. I'm talking about a political system, and that's what Zionism is. Go back into the archives and check that out. And if you can't find it, email me, and I'll send you a link to it. But what I'm telling you about the connection between porn and Zionism is that it's true, and you need to remember that. And then look it up. Do your own research. Don't believe me. Don't believe the entire show I did on that. Look it up and follow the yellow brick road. Look at where the money's at in the porn industry. But more on Zionism a little later in the show. So what these people are doing, these stinking thinkers, is that they're trying to mainstream the discussion of porn and children. So what teachers are asked to do is destigmatize porn. Is it even a stigma anymore? That's the question. But to have porn and children in the same sentence, it gets me a sick stomach, folks. But they're asking the teachers to treat it as just one more legitimate option among many. Option for what? You know, they argue that some people like Coca-Cola and others like Pepsi and others like BDSM and deviant sexual practices. What are we talking about here? This is absolutely insane. Beware, folks. This revolution isn't going to stop with simple porn literacy for children. None of these several articles that I've been talking about on porn literacy explicitly discuss childhood participation in porn, but let's think about this logically for a minute. Porn literacy, children watching it, the porn involving children, isn't that far-fetched when you see everything else that's happened. nor would it be unexpected. And remember, back during the hearings for SCOTUS, the Biden regime's SCOTUS nominee, Ketanji Brown Jackson, we played this clip on her being easy on pedophiles. Could this be why?
In comes the internet. On the internet, with one click, you can receive, you can distribute tens of thousands. You can be doing this for 15 minutes, and all of a sudden, you are looking at 30, 40, 50 years in prison.
Good. Good.
I understand.
Absolutely good. I hope you are.
To do
good.
Allow her to finish, please.
I hope you go to jail for 50 years if you're on the internet trolling for images of children in sexual exploitation. So you don't think that's a bad thing. I think that's a horrible thing.
That's not what the witness said, and she should be allowed.
Folks, that was Lindsey Brown. Think whatever you may of him, but at least he spoke up there. This is sick. And now she sits on our Supreme Court. And I suspect this is why she's light on the sentencing of people convicted of child porn, because this is their next step in this construction of a stable society based on mom and dad and family built upon Judeo-Christian ideals, you know, the plum square level cornerstone. And they want to build a building, our society, which will lean, eventually fail, and fall. That's how they deconstruct stable societies, folks. They just start to nibble at the edges like termites, like water getting into the roof and starting to rot the trusses. Folks, this is sick. It's out of square, unlevel, unplumb. This porn literacy movement that's a foot in academia now and moving towards the educational mainstream must be stopped. And you can do it the way I outlined at the beginning of the show. Think about it. It embraces the idea of children watching many varieties of pornography. They say children should be watching this. So the next illogical question is, in their twisted way of thinking, their bent minds would be, well, should they participate in it? Now, right now, that's against the law. But you heard what Jackson said during her hearings for nomination as Supreme Court Justice. I already think they're working on that. They're scheming with their indirect strategies to get around such prohibitions. Subverting these norms is part of the porn literacy game and Marxist ideology in general, folks. Think about it. 10 years ago, who would have thought young children could be legally castrated in the name of gender ideology? So is porn literacy as unthinkable and its natural outcome as unthinkable as you and me, normal people, might think? Remember, we are dealing with a ruling revolution, a Marxist revolution, folks, and we need to stand up and say no more. Ruling it back requires that you and me strike at that the basic assumptions of their ideology. We need to point out that their cornerstone, their foundation is neither square, plumb, or level. And I'm going to get into that at the end of the show, and I'm going to share what Pastor Todd shared with us last week in church. So we don't want to just go after the manifestations. We want to go after the core ideology and show how stupid it is, how out of plumb it is, how unlevel and out of square it is, and what it's going to do to anything we build upon it. Now, we're also going to be covering intersectionality in our Back to the Future segment, so stay tuned. But one more in the Kabuki Theater update before we move on. Did you hear the latest news this week from Canada? Justin Trudeau just announced yesterday that it's no longer legal to buy, sell, or transfer a handgun in Canada. Have a listen.
In May, our government introduced measures to implement a national freeze on handgun ownership. Today, our national freeze on handguns is coming into force. From today forward, it is no longer legal to buy, sell, or transfer a handgun in Canada.
Wow. Now, folks, you know this is necessary. We'll be covering next in our newest segment titled Follow the Yellow Brick Road. And I'll explain to you why on the other side.
Follow the Yellow Brick Road. Follow the yellow brick road. Follow the yellow brick road. Follow the yellow brick road.
Follow the yellow brick road.
Follow the yellow brick road. Follow the yellow brick road. Follow, 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 follow the yellow brick road. Follow the yellow brick, follow the yellow brick, follow the yellow brick road. You're up to see the river, the wonderful river of Oz. You find it in the winter of Oz, if ever a winter was. If ever a winter of Oz, there was the winter of Oz. We won because of the wonderful things he does. You're up to see the river, the wonderful river of Oz.
Now, you know, the Bible says that for the love of money is the root of all evil. Keep that in mind, folks. And the reason I play this clip for the Yellow Brick Road is that all you have to do to find out who's behind all of this is follow the money trail. And that's what the Yellow Brick Road was in The Wizard of Oz. It was the great battle going on between the gold and the silver interests in America at the time. And now we have neither, but both were real and legitimate money. What we have today is currency. Funny money, fiat money, paper money, dead presidents. Call it whatever you want, but there's nothing to it. And the reason Trudeau has to take the handguns away, the reason all of this is shaping up is that when they take our currency away from us, greenback, and remember, cash is king. You're not traced by it. You're not controlled by it. As long as you have it in your pocket, you can open doors with it. You can buy things. You can do things with it. That away and make it a central bank digital currency. They have all the control. Now, Forbes, the respected magazine Forbes, is out there telling us why we should be excited about CBDC.
What?
That's right, Paul. So let's have a listen to this sick article. And it's about a four-minute clip, and it's on Forbes magazine's website. Why we should all be excited by central bank digital currency.
Why you should be excited for a central bank digital currency, CBDC. By William Anderson. Blockchain technology is still under development. During the peak hype of 2020 and 2021, the future was here and buzz was extreme for Bitcoin, Ethereum, non-fungible tokens, NFTs, and the wide array of other coins and tools coming onto the market. During that time, I was able to visit about half a dozen conferences and dozens of meetups and parties that were a part of the scene. So many new concepts and approaches came and went, but they all focused on speculation and were driven by incredibly early adopters, many of whom were in it for the quick cash turnaround gains. What was and is missing is stability and foundational technology layers. The state then for blockchain tech was rough, with any new startup needing to build most of the foundational technology they needed themselves. This means spending time on work not core to their product idea, value proposition. Mass adoption was being pushed for, but with nothing to appeal to the masses. Bitcoin BTC 0.0% being a speculative asset is a tough sell for most of the US, and while those who already hold some may still be excited, the holdouts, most people, are skeptical. There is a tremendous amount that can and will be done with blockchain, just as there was with the web, but to really get people on board we need reasons for adoption. A central bank digital currency, CBDC, is a cryptocurrency whose liability rests with a central bank. The closest we have to this in example in the US is paper money. Anyone can use it, but its value and distribution are backed by the government, who is ultimately responsible for its existence. While digital currency itself, such as paying online with credit cards, or making transfers with PayPal or Venmo, is ubiquitous in the United States, the accountability for this money is managed by private businesses, not the government. A CBDC would create a new standard of payment in the U.S., allowing for a much more real digital economy. By having the Federal Reserve take this on, citizens could each be issued their own account, which could be used for receiving stimulus, governmental benefits, and if we got our act together, taxes and tax reporting. Having a CBDC representative of the US dollar wouldn't mean banks go away or the death of other cryptocurrencies, In fact, it would bolster them. Banks should also be allowed to receive and custody this the same. Your accounts could look identical to today. Transfers would be instant, even between institutions. Banks are still valuable because they offer protection and remediation for issues from fraud to human error. Sometimes it's nice to be able to call someone for assistance. Private crypto wallets could also be built to work with the infrastructure, enabling you to create and manage accounts in a way that works well for you. Holding your own money. With the citizenry all having access to an account containing a US CBDC, it would mean more of the country would be banked, and new companies could bring novel infrastructure and applications to an entire country worth of users. While many tools and technologies will help on the journey to unlocking the potential of the blockchain, an instant boom of 210 million users, the estimated U.S. population over 18, would promote innovation beyond any scale we have seen so far.
So there you have it. Now, did you hear that one line in there? She said paper money. We lost paper money when actually it died in two steps. First one, FDR seized all the gold and made it illegal and paid the American public $20 an ounce and then immediately revalued it at $33 an ounce. At that point, paper money became oxymoronic because money has value. And prior to that move by FDR, and I guess you could say that, you know, you had those redeem notes. They were redemption notes. So payable upon demand. You could take that piece of paper to the bank and they would give you an ounce of silver for a dollar bill. Coin, which was the legal and lawful money of the time as defined in the Constitution. And then you could take a $20 bill and get an ounce of gold. But that kind of stopped there when he revalued gold. But the silver continued all the way up to 64. And then it really became an oxymoron when in, I think it was 71, Nixon took the gold and completely decoupled it from the dollar and created the petrodollar. But I'm starting to get off track here. The point I'm trying to make is that this isn't all wonderful like the article from Forbes tried to make you think. Now, Bitcoin can be considered a cashless type of transaction vehicle also, but the difference is that Bitcoin and all the other cryptos are decentralized as opposed to these centralized central bank digital currencies. And what the central bank's trying to do is control it all, control us. Now, remember a week or two ago, we played that clip from Dan Bongino's show where he had Layla Hepburn on. Let's just play the one clip from Dan Bongino's show where he talks about money controlling the world.
Because it is digital, it means the money can be programmed to be spent in any way in which the central bank or the government decides. So one of my particular concerns is the World Economic Forum, because they're talking about implementing a carbon allowance. Now, this means each individual will be given a certain amount of, whether it's credit or whatever it is, carbon that they are allowed to emit. And how do they implement that? Through a central bank digital currency. So if I buy too many plane tickets or if I buy too much meat, because those things are all supposedly very bad for the environment, my money when I go to fill up my car could then be declined. So now they're literally controlling what we can and can't do with our money. It's also important to realize that the money can expire. So during times of economic uncertainty, central banks love to print lots and lots of money, which causes inflation. But we could get to a point where they say, instead of printing money, you have to spend at least 10% of your savings in the next 3 months. If you don't spend that money in the next 3 months, then that money is going to expire. And if you can't save money, well, then you can't build long-lasting generational wealth. You're always going to be a slave to the system. And, you know, I don't think people really understand the severity of this. Money is literally the energy which fuels your life. If you don't have freedom of money, you don't have freedom of anything. You know, Dan, I know you talk about the Second Amendment. You know, if they don't need to necessarily get rid of the Second Amendment, but they can just say they can program your money so that you can't actually go and buy a gun. So, again, it really is the most tyrannical form of surveillance we will ever see. When they control the money, they control the world.
When they control the money, they control the world. So that was Layla Hepburn on Dan Bongino's show. And I just cut out the parts with Dan commenting. But when they control the money, folks, they control the world. And we've been saying this in alt media from day one. And I've been talking about the petrodollar since we started these podcasts back in 2010. And I'm telling you, we should not embrace the central bank digital currency. Because when we do, we lose all autonomy regarding our financial world. Now, even some people in the Federal Reserve are speaking out against it, and this is their controlled opposition. I think what they do is these Luciferians always tell you their plan, and they always give you an option, and this is all done voluntarily. Nobody's going to hold you down and shove the vaccine in your arm. Nobody's going to hold you down and force you to use this. But you're going to find it more convenient. You're going to have incentives to use it. And then once they have you in there using the system, that's when they spring the trap. It's like the way you trap wild hogs in the forest, you know? If you have feral pigs, what you do is you start setting fence posts in the area that you're feeding them daily, day by day. And then you start building the pen. And the pigs become so comfortable with what they see around them as they eat up that food because it's convenient, it's free, it's fun. They don't have to forage for it. And then the last day, you have that gate open, and as they're in there paying no attention to their surroundings, you just close the gate and you caught the feral pigs. Try catching a feral pig anywhere, any way else, folks. It's very difficult. It's like the pot of boiling water with the frog, you know. The frog just gets comfortable in there and dies. Well, I'm telling you, the Federal Reserve is even speaking out against it now. At least one of their members is, and this is an article from techstory.in. The United States doesn't need a CBDC, says Federal Governor. Now, this was written by Rishabh Agarwal on October 15th, and he says that almost all major countries are now working on the CBDCs, and we've covered that. And some have already launched, like China, and we're going to hear a little bit more on that later in these next two clips. And some within these systems are actually asking whether there's a real need for this. And one of these people is Federal Reserve Governor Christopher Waller. And he says he doesn't think we need a CBDC. So he's probably controlled opposition, or maybe he actually believes this, but he's actually speaking the truth. He said that the factors supporting the primacy of the dollar are not technological. And he's right about that too, folks. So he says that the idea of the U.S. Federal Reserve planning to issue digital dollars is not something we see a need for. He says factors supporting the primacy of the dollar are not technological, but include the ample supply and liquid market for U.S. Treasury securities and other debt and the longstanding stability of the U.S. economy and political system. So he's saying, and I think he's saying it rightly, that a CBDC wouldn't play a role in the economy of the United States. And folks, that's the truth. It's not about the economy. It's about control. So Waller doesn't believe much in this idea of a CBDC for economic reasons. Now, the true reason for it is control, and we're going to see that a little bit later. Remember, CBDC defeats the purpose of a cryptocurrency, which is autonomy and privacy. Cryptocurrencies are meant to liberate the people, whereas CBDCs are meant to enslave the people. And I believe it's part of the beast system, folks. You know, Bitcoin was designed in such a way that it cuts out the intermediaries. And there's a traditional payment system, and it ensures that the sender and the receiver connect directly. It takes out the bank. It takes out any third-party liability. You know, your deposits in the bank have been laid down, so to speak. You have surrendered those, and you are not the primary beneficiary of that anymore. The bank is, so they can do these things called bail-ins. But crypto eliminates all that. It reduces the friction and payment costs and any risk of censorship. Now, on the other hand, these CBDCs, they will be directly controlled by the authorities, and so the users will have very little, if any, control, like we heard Halperin say. So that's why it's so important, folks, that we stand up and say no to these things. Call your representatives, get involved, and say no. Now, even the IMF is admitting it. And that's like I said, they use this thing called lesser magic. So they tell you what they're doing. They give you options before they do it. So over at the Gateway Pundit, there was an article titled Global Finance Elites Meet to Discuss Digital Currencies Used to Control People with the Use of Digital Scores. And that's the social credit system that we've learned about in China. And, you know, when I first heard about that, and I don't know if it was Brother Alex that sent that to my attention or one of the other listeners, it was back in 2018. I remember it so clearly, folks. I kind of poo-pooed the whole idea. And here we are 4 years later, and it's actually starting to unfold. But this talk they gave at this one economics meeting, the IMF insiders were speaking, and this one IFM spokesperson, Bo Lee, he basically said it all. And I'd like to play this minute and a half clip for you. He's an Asian man, so there's a little bit of a broken speech there, but just listen, and you're going to hear some things, but I guarantee it will blow your mind.
The third way we think CBDC can improve financial inclusion is through what we call programmability. That is, CBDC can allow government agencies and private sector players to program, to create smart contracts, to allow targeted policy functions. For example, welfare payment. For example, consumption coupon. For example, food stamp. By programming CBDC, those money can be precisely targeted for what kind of people can own and what kind of use this money can be utilized, for example, for food. So this potential programmability can help government agencies to precisely target their support to those people who need support. So that way can also improve financial inclusion. Of course, I want to end with a caveat, because CBDC is not a panacea. CBDC cannot solve every challenge in financial inclusion. There are some aspects of financial inclusion is not related to technology. For example, financial literacy, digital literacy. So CBDC has to work with other policies together to try to improve financial inclusion. I stop here.
Did you hear that, folks? He admitted that not only the governments, but certain elements of the private sector can use these CBDCs to program smart contracts to target policies. And now, who wouldn't want to see this control in the welfare system and with food stamps? How many times have you stood behind somebody in the grocery store using one of those cards? Now they look like a debit card, but it's basically food stamps. And you see them buying steaks and soda and all kinds of treats, and you just say, boy, I wish I could spend that kind of money. And they're paying for it. So the argument's going to be, oh, we're going to be able to control that. And people are going to say, that's those welfare people on the dole to get all those good foods. They're going to be limited to the basics. And so they're going to embrace it at first. But then again, it just moves more and more towards control, not just of those people, but of all of us. And remember, Trudeau took the guns away in Canada, and now you can't protest in any way that's meaningful. When they come and kick your door down, how do you defend yourself? See how this all fits together, folks? Well, this IFM spokesperson, Bo Lee, drops even more bombshells concerning CBDC. He goes on to admit that service providers can use transactional data to underwrite credit for social scoring. I mean, can you make this stuff up? And then he uses some examples of how coffee purchases in China were tracked. And when he used the Uber. Folks, do you want the government knowing everything you buy and where you go? Well, this is how they're going to be able to do it. When they don't like you, or when you're at a school board meeting speaking out against this porn literacy or this transgenderism, and they don't like your behavior, they'll just shut off your money. They're going to do. Have a listen to Bo Lee admitting that CBDC tracks your data.
Bo, just a quick question. When you look out at what's happening so far in this sphere,
mm-hmm.
Do you see any ways in which, you know, the transaction data so helpful are being used now or could be used or should be put into a plan? Just any specific example?
Well, I can give you one example in China, because I personally experienced it, right? Those transaction data can be utilized by service providers in credit underwriting, in the sense that, you know, those transaction data in terms of how many coffee I drink every day, where I buy coffee, do I use Uber every day, and what kind of working hours I have, those non-traditional data can be very useful for financial service providers to give me a credit score. And based on a credit score, the financial service provider give me a credit line without any face-to-face due diligence. That's a big saving, because traditionally, you know, banks, they need to do due diligence. They need to meet with us face-to-face. They need to even visit my home if they want to give me a home equity loan, right? So there's a lot of cost associated with traditional credit underwriting. But the non-traditional credit underwriting is based on data. And there is no need for face-to-face meeting. And it's much faster and much cheaper. And that's a way to create value. And we see a lot of that already in China, because we have very good mobile payment system in China. And those service providers, they are providing a lot of additional financial service in addition to payment.
Right.
And that can be very profitable. And that's the value we are talking about, to make it attractive to private sector players to join this ecosystem.
Sure. Well,
so there you have it, folks. And, you know, we've played this clip numerous times. I'm not going to play it today. Maybe next week in the opening I'll play it. But the Plandopolis clip, where they're going to tell you where your children have to go to school and what they have to study and what they will do for a career, when you can buy meat, when you can't, whether you can travel or not, where you live. That's where this is all headed, folks. Now, in a wrap-up, let's just talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly. And let's start with the bad news first. The bad news is that this will eventually happen, and I'm telling you, it's going to happen on a horrific scale. And what's worse is that most of the people are going to sign up to it blindly, because they're going to be given perks and they're going to be given arguments like, oh, it's going to control the welfare system and make it more effective. Now, many people who you never imagined are going to sign up for it, in fact, they're going to do it for even other reasons, you know? And when it does come, there's going to be no way out of it except through death. And that's the truth. Now, the good news is this doesn't actually happen until the last 7 years of the world. And if you know your Bibles, folks, you know what I'm talking about. So, yes, they're going to implement it, and it's going to happen before people realize how dangerous this is. So they're going to get a lot of the village idiots, so to speak, to sign up. But ultimately, it fails, and it fails worldwide. But in the beginning, it's going to look really good. And they're setting up for this right now. That's what they're doing. Okay? So that's what you're seeing happening, and that's the truth. And there are these different groups of thought leaders in all of these non-governmental organizations like the World Economic Forum, you know, praising this and making it so wonderful. So at the beginning of the last 7 years of this world, it's going to be voluntary. But at the midway mark, at 3.5 years, it's going to become mandatory. And now for the ugly news. Folks, I'm telling you, the world is on a course that cannot and will not be stopped ultimately. Now, along the way, we can make life better for ourselves and our local communities if we build on a square, level, and plumb cornerstone. But I'm telling you, folks, the truth is, and if you've read your Bibles, you know the end of the story. Jesus wins. So these things will happen. However, it doesn't happen when and exactly we think it will. It happens when God says it will. Even those setting it up and thinking they're in control aren't in control. Ultimately, God's in control. So those in charge will be taken out at some point, and they're going to be replaced. And although they all are technically marching in lockstep through the hive mind that St. John talked about in Revelation, they all think they have the ultimate goal, really know what's behind this. And this is to seek the Antichrist. So you and me as believers, we have an advantage. And I'm telling you, people are eventually and ultimately going to have to pick a side. And the choices aren't going to be left or right, Democrat or Republican, blue or red. The choice is going to be good or evil. Like Moses wrote in Deuteronomy, choose life, not death. Choose blessings, not curses. So folks, you need to be preparing your heart and your soul for these things right now. You know, this is going to be the ultimate battle, but it's going to be literally finished before it even starts as Jesus opens his mouth, the truth. You know, in the Battle of Armageddon, it's God versus the devil, so to speak, in a lot of people's minds, but it's really no fight at all. Now, you know, the devil disguises himself as God. We know that. So you better know your Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, in a relationship. And you need to do that before it's too late. Folks, I'm telling you, it's going to be very hard to know the difference when this all happens unless you're grounded on the rock right now. And you have to make sure that your faith is square, plumb, and level now, not when all the bad things start happening. But we have to keep moving, folks. And right with Henrietta. So this is our prepping section where we prep anywhere from politics, and I've told you, get involved on the local level to food production and prep for any disaster and just the preparation in general. Today, because of the season and what I just finished up here on the property, I want to cover some gardening 101, and that's putting your garden to bed for the winter. And there's 11 steps that you can do, and this was over at gardenista.com. But as the air gets crisp and the days get shorter, you know, the cold weather's starting to creep in, you don't leave your garden that way with all the dead plants in there. No, you have to put it to bed, so to speak. So before you put your gardening gloves and your shovel away, make sure that you've put your garden to bed. And you do that by harvesting the remaining crops that you might have. And don't forget about those green tomatoes, folks. You can take those and make different relishes and salsas, and how about fried green tomatoes? Or you can take the ones that are bruise-free and very good condition and put them on their own. Now, they're not as good as a vine-picked ripe fruit, but they're still pretty good. And then you want to harvest some of your cold and tolerant vegetables, you know, like the tomatoes and all that. And you're going to be harvesting for a while some of your colder vegetables like cabbage and your fall lettuce and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And then just make sure your perennial crops are all trimmed down, like your rosemaries and your oreganos and your sages and asparagus and whatever else you might have. Get that part of the bed all weeded and set up. And then number four, get all the garden waste out of there. Now, some people say compost it, but I don't like that because if there's any pathogens or molds or blights in there and you don't get that compost pile hot enough, when you bring that compost material back into your garden, you're going to cause that to reinfect your new plants next year. So I say just throw it away. And then get your soil tested. You can do that at your local agricultural extension, or you can go to your garden center and buy a home test. Make sure your calcium levels are right and all the other chemistries in there. And you can lime your garden if it's too acidic, and you can do some treatments if it's too alkali with citric acid and very benign material called amending your soil. And then if you have some good mulch, mulch it. Or do a green cover crop. We like to put winter rye down, and it actually grows up, and your garden actually looks like grass in the spring. We let it grow up to about maybe a foot long. I mow it down and then plow it in. And then you can repair any of your garden structures like trellises or fences. Get all your tools cleaned up. And I like to take some used motor oil and just kind of wipe it down on the blades of the shovels and the tines of the hose and all that. And then make some notes. What worked and what didn't work. Keep a notebook. And this is when you can also plant some of your cold tolerant plants like your garlic for next year. You can even get some of your onion bulbs in and things like that. And even some things like lettuces. And then when the spring comes, they'll start to sprout. And they're very frost resistant. So that's what you should be doing in your garden right now. And it's very important that you're able to supply yourself with some food. Keep moving right now, folks. And right now, it's time for our Hopium Report.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Hopium Report, where dreamers of all sorts come for their faith snort. Prepare to get high on Hopium. Now, I put this next story in the Hopium Report because I hope that people wake up when they hear this man speak before the election here in Pennsylvania, and they don't vote for him. So this clip is Lieutenant Governor Fetterman, who's running for the state Senate seat from Pat Toomey, who is stepping down. And his opponent is Dr. Oz, the carpetbagger. Now, I know people might not think Dr. Oz is all he's cut out to be, but folks, that's the only choice we have right now. So this clip I'm going to play for you right now is at a rally that Fetterman did. And, you know, let's have some respect for this man. He did have a stroke back in May, pretty bad shape. And in fact, in a recent interview he did with NBC, and he's very upset, and his wife's actually suing NBC over this, but he had to use a giant monitor with closed captioning during the recent interview because he cannot process the verbal word. He has to look at the written word. Remember, this man wants to be our senator in Washington. But just listen to this rally. And this is the music he played, and then this is him speaking, and he's talking about, I will fight work to work. What's that mean? Wow. Now, like I said, I put this in the Hopium Report because I hope people wake up when they hear him. And remember, folks, he is He's involved in the election still. And he calls people that question the results here in Pennsylvania and elsewhere around the country election deniers. But they're the ones that cheat, folks. And here's what he said during the whole election 2020 scandal.
So this idea that saying that Pennsylvania was rigged or that we were trying to steal the election, unquote, that's a lie. And that you do not have the right. That is not protected speech. The second those tweets went up, they should have been deleted. That's not deplatforming someone. It's deleting lies that are yelling fire in a crowded theater when there is none. And there's a difference. That is not protected speech. He can talk all day about what his favorite football team is or that he's the greatest president in the history of the world. But no one, Republican, Democrat, whatever, has the right to say those kind of incendiary lies.
So that was pre-stroke. He was articulate, but he had a very twisted thought. You know, just looking at this man, he wears a hoodie and shorts, and he's asking the American voters in Pennsylvania here, elect him for Senate. Yet he looks like a hooded thug, he really does, folks. And that alone should stop people from voting for him. Remember, he's asking us to give him our vote. I certainly hope you don't do that. I really hope you don't do that, folks. Anyways, I was rambling there. I'm looking for from Josh Shapiro, where he said before the election in 2020 that when all the ballots are counted, Trump will lose. And he's running for our governor. These men have to be stopped. And if people like Fetterman even get 20% of the votes here in PA, there should be an immediate hand count of all ballots. I'm not joking, because how can anybody vote for this? I'm telling you, Fetterman's reminds me in some ways of Obama. When you look at his eyes, there's a darkness in them. It truly is. And, you know, those of you who listen to the show know that I bumped into Obama back in 2007 during his campaign for president during his first election run. I literally bumped into him. I was late for a meeting and he was going to a fundraiser and we kind of bumped into each other in the hall, and I had Secret Service men on me literally, and
5 seconds, but I got to look into Obama's eyes, and I'm telling you, it was creepy. It was creepy. And when I look at Fetterman's eyes, I see the same thing. So I'm telling you, Fetterman has that same spirit in him that I saw in Obama. So would you choose somebody with that spirit? No, I'm going to call it what it is. It's the spirit of Antichrist. But would you choose that over Dr. Oz, even with all of his limitations? Seriously, would you? And I've noticed as I watch some of these clips, and there's not a lot of people, but the people that do come to these events for Fetterman, they have that same look in their eyes. And I'm telling you, that's really sad. It truly is. We have to keep our absurdian reports.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the world of the absurd. This is the Absurdium Report.
Life mimics theater, but fiction is safer. The curtain rises. The show begins.
Now, this next clip is built upon this lawsuit that's happening right now in California. It's been filed by a teacher, actually by the Thomas More Society, on behalf of this teacher who was fired allegedly for refusing to read these LGBT books to five-year-olds in her class. So that's what this is all about. And what I'd like to do is just give you a little background before we actually cover this. But there's this educator named Nellie Parentsova. She sounds like she's from Eastern Europe. And, you know, a lot of the Eastern Europeans have very solid ethics and morality just because of their upbringing. But she's suing this group known as Bright Horizons. It's a nationwide child care facility for alleged religious discrimination, harassment, and retaliation. And this is all according to a press release from her lawyers at the Thomas More Society. So Parentsova, she worked for Bright Horizons Studio City, a location in California, for the past 4 years. And the litigation that she's filed with the Thomas More Society claims that after the Studio City location director discovered that she had Christian beliefs and didn't want to read these perverted books to the five-year-olds, the director enforced company policy requiring all teachers to support and promote celebrations of diversity, including same-sex marriage, to five-year-olds in their child care program. So what I'd like to do right now is play a clip from Bright Horizons spokesperson talking about their commitment to diverse authors. And this is a 2-minute and 12-second clip. The audio is a little bit off, but this was a YouTube problem, not mine, but I think it's valuable enough to listen to. And remember, we're talking today about building upon the rock, the square, plumb, and level rock in all that we think, say, and do. And this is an example where that's not happening.
I am fanatic about children's books. I read them, I collect them, I get them, and I've written a few of them. Children's books are a powerful tool in developing early language and literacy skills. So much so that research has found books in a child's home and daily reading can be a differentiator in long-term reading success. But children's books do so much more. They teach children about day-to-day life and the broader world around them. They boost social-emotional skills like empathy and emotional awareness. They teach about the past and the present, fantasy and real life. And they foster an understanding of humans. They build children's perspective, their compassion, curiosity, acceptance, and help children explore their own identity. Historically, children's books have not represented diversity very well, nor have there been many diverse authors or illustrators. This is important because a sense of belonging and inclusion starts from the very beginning. Representation matters. and stories and perspective matter too. Plus, children learn about each other and the beauty and strength in differences through the subtle messages and depictions in the pages of a story. The publishing industry is making progress, and more children and families are represented. Differences depicted positively, and we have broadened our spectrum of what is celebrated and elevated. We at Bright Horizons are proud to say that we have a signature children's literacy program, Growing Readers, for over 20 years. This year, as a way to enrich our program, we are showcasing the many Growing Readers selections that highlight the work of talented, diverse authors and illustrators, and we are committing to selecting new books that represent various aspects of diversity in each edition of our Growing Readers Review.
Wow. That was absolutely disgusting. Who in the world with any decency would engage young children in this vile sexual abuse? It's awful, folks. I just question, is it even legal? Well, we see now that some governors in conservative states are actually outlawing a lot of these family-friendly drag shows and, you know, storybook reading hours in the libraries. I just can't believe that a school, a daycare center, produces a video promoting their commitment to, and I quote, diverse authors. Well, just how diverse are they, really? And, you know, I would just love to see somebody start reading authors like Ben Shapiro, Dennis Prager. Some of these guys actually wrote children's books. So let's just say that they are embracing this commitment to diverse authors. Would they read a children's book written by Ben Shapiro or Dennis Prager or Larry Elder? How about Glenn Beck? I think Glenn's written some children's books. Or Candace Owens. Or let's even go a step further. You think they would let these people read something written by an author as diverse as St. John or Moses? I hardly think so, folks. And don't even get me started on Matt Walsh. We did a couple clips on him. Could you imagine if they read something that Matt Walsh wrote? You know, one of us out there ought to become a substitute teacher and read some of these things from these people I just mentioned to these children. Hey, Alex, aren't you a teacher? Sounds like a plan, doesn't it? But I'm just joking with that. We got to keep moving, and right now it's time for Ken's Corner, spelled with a K.
Welcome to Ken's Corner, spelled with a K, where I'll share my life experiences to help you understand what's going on in this crazy, crazy world. So let's get started.
Now, this next segment, I'm going to talk about Kanye West, who now goes by Ye. He's in the news again, folks. I mean, you may have heard he just purchased Parler, but he's out there right now. And some of his interviews are going viral. And I'm going to play a clip out of the one that really started it all. And there's a profanity warning here. He drops the F-bomb. So if you got any young children, please get them out of the room. But Kanye West was on Drink Champs. And it was a controversial interview. And it's actually been pulled from YouTube and even the Revolt franchise website. And Kanye told them this was going to happen. And it's all being done under the guise or the moniker of anti-Semitism. A website received backlash after West's anti-Semitic comments and lies about the death of George Floyd. You know, what he said about George Floyd is that George Floyd had fentanyl in his system, and he died of the fentanyl overdose and not from what the officers did. Now, I don't want to get into all that, but I'm going to tell you this much. I'm going to tell you that at first it may sound like Kanye speaking crazy, but if you do a little research on any of this, you're going to see that Kanye isn't. So this first clip is from the Drink Champs video, and I did catch it before I did get to download it. And I'll tell you, the first hour is significant, and it's worth listening to. But this is about a 2-minute and 30-second clip out of that where he calls out the Zionists. And he's using the term Jew. Okay? But just take a listen, and then we'll talk.
We Jews, I can't be anti-Semite.
Right.
First of all, I need my four stadiums back. The 78 media outlets to call me abuser when I was trying to get that heroin addict away from my kids that was tattooing my kids' names on them, Skeet, Pete Davidson. They popping up. You know what I'm saying? It's like they Trevor Noah, not even from America.
Right.
He just looked black.
Right?
Right? Gonna say, yo, Kim, it's gonna get dangerous. So they putting all that, he crazy. He's so OJ.
Right.
Nori just want the family back together.
Right.
I just want the family back together.
Right.
Kim is a Christian. On TMZ, I just saw yesterday, they said Pete Davidson and Kim have sex by the fireplace to honor their grandmother. It's Jewish Zionists that's about that life that's telling this Christian woman that has four black children to put that out as a message in the media. So when I drive by and I see the Hulu ads and I say the J.P. Chase Morgan ads, I'm going to let y'all know right now, the devil is a defeated foe. You can't poison me. And by the way, y'all done already fucked with me so much. Y'all already black mirrored me. You already made everybody think I'm crazy. You already took my family away. You already separated all my friends. I don't got no celebrity friends. Because when I was on TV, on Instagram saying, I don't know where my child is, and the Kardashians kidnapped my daughter in public, and I didn't have the address of my child, none of these niggas that want
to
say something
Travis
now.
Travis gave you the address, though?
Travis gave me the address.
Right.
But as far as Meek Mills, no. Puff Daddy, whoever, none of these niggas. All you fake hard niggas, fuck you.
Wait, hold on.
Okay. All you fake hard niggas, fuck you. You know what I'm saying? I don't give a fuck because you can't shoot nobody anyway. And the reason why you got talks is because you did a deal, you fucking fed. You know what I'm saying? That's why you got to come at me because part of the deal for you to be a daughter and get out of jail is that you promised that you're going to go pull my co-car. So y'all niggas shut the fuck up about me. Now let me say it calm. You niggas shut the fuck up about, you shut the fuck up about Michael.
Right.
I'm Michael now.
Right,
every
right.
Michael you can think of,
right.
But mostly Godfather Michael now.
Okay, so you just, maybe scratching your head and say, bro, Ken, why are you talking about Ye, this guy known as Kanye West? And why is it in Ken's corner? Well, like I said, I listened to the first hour of this. Ethan from the plant said, hey, you got to listen to this. And you got to get past all of the emotion, and you got to get past all the lingo from the rapper world, and you got to listen to what he's saying. And I'm telling you, folks, Kanye is speaking more truth there than most people care to admit. Now, that's why I said that, and I think it's very important that if you go to school board meetings, you must remain calm, because when Kanye started having his rant there, he starts to lose credibility. And when he talks about Jews, immediately the anti-Semite flag goes up. So you have to do your research, and you have to be very careful. And then he says, well, I'm black and I'm a Jew. Well, you know, there were the Ethiopian Jews. And he needs to be very careful and explain all that, because people are going out there fact-checking and they're thinking he's crazy. You know, there was one part in the interview where Kanye said, if you're running down the highway in gym trunks and sweating and you're the only one doing it, you're considered crazy. But if you're doing it with 1,000 other people, it's called a marathon. And my point is that he's right on there about Zionism, which is very different than ethnic Jewry and Sephardic Jews in terms of their bloodline. And it's a completely different animal than the religious Jewry of the Ashkenazi. So, you know, the Ashkenazi kind of merged into the faith in, I think it was the 8th century. And earlier than that, the Edomites did it. And when Jesus talked about the Jews, and he didn't walk in Judah anymore because of Jewry, as St. John wrote, he wasn't talking about his brothers and sisters. He was talking about those who came in to the faith, the Pharisees, who most of them weren't even ethnic Sephardic Jews. They were like the Ashkenazi. They were the Edomites. Did you know that? And it's all in the Bible, folks. But you have to read the King James to see it, because too many of the key words that you need to do your research have been masked or obscured in some of the modern translations. And I often wonder why. But I'm getting off course here. So let's get back to the whole thing about Zionism. And the best way to learn about this is from journalist and author Jim Mars. in one of his best books titled Rule by Secrecy, The Hidden History That Connects the Trilateral Commission, the Freemasons, and the Great Pyramids. Now, this was written by Jim Mars a while back. And by the way, folks, I did interview Jim before his death back on the old Tribulation show we did with John and Kathy. But John, in one of his irrational moods, deleted all of these old archive shows, so we lost so much, folks. But in this book, Jim Mars asks a couple questions. He says, what connects the Great Pyramids, the Masons, and the Council on Foreign Relations? And what he does is he looks at the workings behind the curtain, so to speak. You know, in The Wizard of Oz, pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. These are some of the world's most closely guarded secrets. This is what Kanye was talking about. He traces the history of the clandestine societies and the power that they've wielded from ancient mystery religions all the way up to the modern conspiracy theories. And folks, these conspiracy theories are actually conspiracy facts, and that's the truth. And that's what Kanye was talking about, and he's not maybe the best in terms of articulation, but think about the platform this man has. He's the richest black man in the world. He's a multi-billionaire, and he built it all up. And now he's speaking the truth, and so I give him some respect for that. But if you want to learn more about this whole Zionism thing, and I'm going to end it with this one comment. Jim Mars says, when you're talking about Zionistic issue, you have to be very careful. And you have to ask yourself, am I talking about a religious Jew, a political Jew, or an ethnic Jew? And that's what I was saying at the beginning. We have to recognize that we don't have anything against our brothers, the ethnic Jews. And we don't have anything against our brothers, the religious Jews. What we have an issue with are the Zionists, the Zionist occupation government. And this is real, folks. This is so real. You can trace it. I did that entire show on the Jewish roots in pornography. And it is. It's Zionists are behind all of that. So I encourage you to go out there and get the book Rule by Secrecy. Open your eyes if you don't understand a lot of this. I wish Jim Mars was still around. He could be clarifying a lot of this. It's too bad that he died. But we have to keep moving, folks. And right now, it's time for Back to the Future, the segment where we take something from the past and bring it back to the future. And today, folks, what we're going to do is we're going to wind the clock back, not that far back, but back to May 5th, 1959. On that day, Kimberly Williams Crenshaw, I guess Kimberly Williams at the time, was born. Now, you might be asking, well, what's so special about some lady, some 63-year-old black woman named Kimberly Williams Crenshaw? Well, Kimberly, spelled with L-E instead of L-Y, and that's L-E with an apostrophe because she's special. Kimberly's an American civil rights advocate and the leading scholar behind what we know today as critical race theory. But hold on, folks, it gets better. Now, she's a professor at the UCLA School of Law and the Columbia Law School, where she specializes in race and gender issues. And she's best known, not for the critical race theory, but for her introduction and development of intersectional theory. Now, this term was coined in 1989 by Professor Kimberly Crenshaw, and she used it to describe how race and class and gender and other individual characteristics intersect, hence the term intersectionality, all with one another, and how they overlap. And she says that intersectionality has, in a sense, gone viral. And this wasn't any of her doing, okay? But anyways, it's resulting now in a backlash from the right. And I think that's pretty much expected. Now, I expected Gomer to say, surprise, surprise, surprise. Where are you, Gomer? Are you snoozing or what? But had you said that, Gomer, I would have said right on. You know why? Because intersectional theory, or intersectionality as some call it, the study of how overlapping and intersecting social identities, particularly among minorities, relate to the systems and structures of oppression, domination, or discrimination. And these are all her words, not mine, folks. So her work further expands and also includes intersectional feminism, which is a subcategory related to the broader intersectional theory. Now, this intersectional feminism examines these overlapping systems of oppression. You know, it's always the downtrodden, isn't it, folks? It's always the victim. And she claims that the discrimination that women face due to their ethnicity, sexuality, and economic background must be corrected. And I'm not arguing with that. But I'm just saying that this is being used for something much more nefarious. Now, this is at least how the Marxist-funded Wikipedia defines her, and that's where I got most of that information. And so you may be scratching your head and saying, well, what's wrong with all that, Bro Ken? We want to take care of the oppressed. Yes, we do. But a quick search is going to uncover the seemingly academic articles that she's written actually have something else behind them. And that thing is the deconstruction of Western society. And you can get into that. You can see it. And there was a really good article that kind of explains what she's all about in more detail. And it was an article published on May 30th, 2019, from Vox.com. And it's a left-leaning publication, but I thought they did a fairly level assessment of what's going on here between the left and the right. And I don't want to get into all of that, but I do want to say that you need to understand this. And I didn't even know about it until Pastor Todd brought it up when I was talking to him the other day. And I just had to study this, and I was like, wow, it's connecting all the dots. Intersectionality, that's what they're using to move these agendas. Now, the controlled media comes out with a hit piece against anybody that questions it. And, of course, it's one of their talking heads, none other than Joy Reid, and she has Kimberly Crenshaw on. And, you know, it is. It's cultural Marxism, folks. That's what it is. Critical race theory, intersectionality, it's all rooted in Marxism, which is to deconstruct a society so they can bring in the oppressive regime. You know, like from Animal Farm, we're all equal, only some of us are more equal than others. So let's listen to this interview, portion of the interview, on Joy Reid's show, where she's asking Kimberly Crenshaw about critical race theory and Marxism.
What people are calling critical race theory, Marxism, racism, bigoted. Let's start with the Marxism. That's their favorite one. They're using that every single time. And I hate to ask dumb questions, so please don't think that I'm dumb. Is critical race theory Marxism?
Look, you know what? Here's the thing, Joy. Critical race theory is not so much a thing. It's a way of looking at a thing. It's a way of looking at race. It's a way of looking at why, after so many decades, centuries, actually, since the emancipation, we have patterns of inequality that are enduring. They are stubborn. And the point of critical race theory originally was to think and talk about how law contributed to the subordinate status of African Americans, of indigenous people, and of an entire group of people who were coming to our shores from Asia. And the point was, quite frankly, to understand the problem in order to intervene in it, to understand why the greatest hopes for our republic were not being realized, even though these hopes were encoded in law. So critical race theory just inherits the beliefs and the hopes of Frederick Douglass, of Martin Luther King, who basically want the law to do for the freed people what the law did for enslavers. And we picked that up in the 70s and 80s after the civil rights movement to say, okay, so now we've had this big civil rights movement. We have all these laws in the books, but things really aren't looking as different as they should.
Okay, so you may be saying, well, why did you play that piece? Now, that was an interview that Joy Reid did with Kimberly back in 2021. And the reason I did it is because she didn't deny in that CRT is Marxism. She chose instead to dance around the question. Did you notice that? So let's hear straight out of the mouth of Kimberly Crenshaw what she has to say about intersectionality.
Intersectionality is just a metaphor for understanding the ways that multiple forms of inequality or disadvantage sometimes compound themselves, and they create obstacles that often are not understood within conventional ways of thinking
about anti-racism or feminism or whatever social justice advocacy structures we have. Intersectionality isn't so much a grand theory, it's a prism for understanding certain kinds of problems. African American girls are 6 times more likely to be suspended than white girls. That's probably a race and a gender problem. It's not just a race problem, it's not just a gender problem. So I encourage people to think about how the convergence of race stereotypes or gender stereotypes might actually play out in the classroom, between teachers and students, between students and other students, between students and administrators, and commit themselves to understanding that as a way of intervening and providing equal educational opportunity for all students, regardless of their identity. Identity isn't simply a self-contained unit. It is a relationship between people in history, people in communities, people in institutions. So schools do a good job when they understand that and when they commit themselves to curricular development, to opportunities in the school for all students to understand the histories that have brought us to this particular moment. You can't change outcomes without understanding how they've come about. So independent schools can take the lead on that to be responsive to their student populations and to the communities out of which the students come.
So there you heard it, folks, out of the mouth of Kimberly Crenshaw herself, the originator of this entire twisted, unlevel, unplumbed, ungrounded thinking known as intersectionality. So I could go on and on about this, could do a whole show on this, but how does this apply today's freaky deaky news headlines? Well, let's go back to Kanye West, who I talked about in Ken's Corner. And, you know, we listened to that clip, and he was all worked up. Well, he's all over right now. He was actually on Chris Cuomo's show. And I just want you to hear this, okay? So he's trying to speak out against Zionism. And just listen to this exchange between Kanye West and Chris Cuomo. It's 2 minutes and 22 seconds long.
Finish what I'm saying.
I know, but you have to understand this idea of the Jewish media. That's not how it works. You're talking to me right now.
La, 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 la. So every celebrity,
go ahead.
Every celebrity has Jewish people in their contract. This is not hate speech. This is the truth. And these people, if you say anything out of the line with the agenda, then your career could be over.
Listen, I hear you. You've made that point.
Why do you keep on cutting off my point?
Because the point is...
Sir, because why do you keep...
Here's why.
Don't cut me off, sir. Respect my
point. I've listened to it. You've made it several times.
No, I'm not finished, sir.
I understand, but you've said it several times.
I'm not finished, sir. But my people haven't heard me. My people, they need to hear. They need to hear me saying out loud what the truth is. There's a bunch of people in Hollywood that are actors, that play basketball, that play sports, that are in music, that know what I'm saying, that feel what I'm saying, and they're happy that I'm saying what I'm saying. It's not from a place of anti-Semitism.
That
some
is
of
inherently
my best friends are
anti-Semitic.
And I'm also Jewish.
And if they're your friends,
some of my best,
if they're
why
your friends,
are you talking over me, bro?
Because
trying
I'm trying to correct what you're saying that is
no, it's not
damaging to decency.
No, yo, but you can't talk over me. You can't
well,
talk over
stop
me.
And give me a chance to make the point that you need
no,
to listen to.
Don't cut off. I need to make a clear point. And when am I allowed to make a point that you don't
You've
cut me off?
You've been talking overwhelmingly during this segment, Ye, and I was I'm
well,
happy to give
me.
You the time. But
no, you're not. No, you're not.
Well, I can't just give you. I can't give you unrestricted license to attack Jewish people
exactly.
and say that
I'm
they're your
attacking.
Friends because that's
Jewish
anti-Semitic.
People.
And it's
okay.
dangerous.
Are you going to give me a platform? Are you going to give me a platform?
I am giving you a platform, but
okay,
I
okay, wait. So you talk and tell me when I can get my
all right, good.
All
right after I ask you this, I'll give you the rest of the time before you go. Here's my all concern right. for you. When I hear how you talk about your personal life and you put things out there and you get into these looping thoughts of what you believe, it sounds to me like you are sometimes out of control and that this is something that you should be dealing with. Now, I'm not excusing your thoughts as illness, okay? People attacked me for that and said, hey.
So Sorry, folks, I had my mute button on. Did you hear that? Cuomo says that Yee's talk is damaging to decency, anti-Semitic, a danger to, and then he pauses and he stops. A danger to what? The status quo, folks, the establishment, the secret societies, the Zionist movement behind a lot of this. And I know I'm dancing on a very fine edge here, and I can do that in podcasts. You can't do this in a lot of other venues. But, folks, follow the yellow brick road. Follow it in pornography. Follow it in finance. Follow it in music. Follow it in sports. And you'll see that what Kanye West says is true, but it's better said as Zionist or Zionism and not Jewry or Judaism or Jews. So here's a guy, a black man named Kanye West, now going as Yee, speaking out against it all. He sees the absurdity with things like Kimberly Crenshaw's loony intersectionality theory. And this guy, Kanye West, Yee, call him whatever you want, sees how control is exerted by the unseen hand, the deep state, the Zionists, also known as the Luciferians. And folks, I covered that in great detail. And again, John's deleted all those shows. But you can see that this is actually happening. Call whatever you want to call it. But those in power try to defy reality. And then we end up in these messes we're in. And that's all by design, folks. Now, today, what I'd like to do to wrap this show up is share a portion of what my pastor, Pastor Todd, talked to us about during his sermon last Sunday. And that's concerning building upon the rock, also known as the cornerstone, also known as Jesus Christ. So as I try to call up one. Okay, here we go. I have it opened up now. Apologize for that. My screen on my iPad shut down, and I have some scriptures I'd like to share with you about the cornerstone, also known as Jesus. Now, the Bible says in Ephesians 2:20 that together we are his house, built upon the foundation of the apostles and the prophets, and the cornerstone is Jesus Christ himself. And St. Peter said in his first letter, chapter 2, verse 7, to who you believe, he is precious. But to those who are disobedient, stone which the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone. Isn't that beautiful, folks? It is. It's just so beautiful. And I can't say enough about the Word of God. And those of you that know me know what it means. I have this crazy thing here in front of my scriptures on this page. It's some ad that keeps popping up, and I can't read the verses. But I wanted to go to Romans chapter 9, verse 33. St. Paul writes, "Behold, I lay in Zion a stone, stumbling in a rock of offense, and he who believes in him will not be disappointed." And then Isaiah also alludes to Jesus as a stone. Isaiah 28:16 says, "Therefore, thus saith the Lord God, behold, I am laying in Zion a stone, a tested stone, a costly cornerstone for the foundation, firmly placed. He who believes in it will not be disturbed." Now, a cornerstone needs to be square, level, and plumb. That's what Pastor Todd talked about. When he said it, it just like exploded in my mind. It really did. And it needs to be firmly placed. And that's how they used to build buildings. And then St. Peter says in 2 Peter chapter 7 and 8, and we read that one, but it finishes, "A stone of stumbling, the rock of offense, for they stumble because they were disobedient to the word, and this doom they were also appointed." Job also writes about it when he said in chapter 38, verses 4 through 6, "Where were you?" And this is God speaking through the author of Job. "Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who set the measurements, since you know? Or who stretched the line on it? Or what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone?" That cornerstone is Jesus. Jeremiah also alludes to it in Jeremiah chapter 51, verse 26. "They will not take from you even a stone for a corner, nor a stone for foundations, but you will be desolate forever, declares the Lord." So people who do not build upon this rock, the cornerstone, the chief cornerstone, Jesus Christ, these people will be desolate forever. And isn't that what we're seeing, folks? Then you also read about it in 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 4 through 8, amplifying what we just heard there. So, building upon the rock is essential. And I want you to buckle your seatbelts and get ready to learn how we must build upon the cornerstone, which is square, level, and plumb, or else everything and anything we ever try to build, including the church, will fail and eventually fall. Anything and everything. Now, I'm not talking about the remnant church. I'm talking about all these churches that pop up all around Christendom. They're going to fail and eventually fall unless they're built upon this stone. Paul wrote in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 1, Therefore, the prisoner of the Lord, beseech you that ye walk worthy of the vocation wherewith ye were called. So, folks, each and every one of you and me who profess to be disciples of Jesus Christ, we're called to walk a life worthy of the calling. So we're given these gifts to use, give back to his body. St. Paul wrote in Ephesians chapter 4, verses 7 through 17, and I'm only going to read the first couple verses. But unto every one of us is given grace, according to the measure of the gift of Christ. Wherefore he saith, when he ascendeth up on high, he led captivity captive and gave gifts unto men. Now that he ascended, what is it but that he also descended first into the lower parts of the earth? That he descended is the same also that ascended up far above all heavens, that he might fill all things. Now, we're not going to get into that ascending and descending. That's what Todd also said on Sunday, because that's a whole nother study for another day. What we're going to focus on right now is the grace that's given. And the point here is that when God gives you or me a gift as a believer, he intends that we give it back. We give it back to the body. Think about it. Paul wrote, given account to the measure of Christ's gift. And what is Christ's gift? Well, he gave you and me his very life. He shed his sacred blood on that cross so that you and I may live. He bore our sins so that we may be set free from sin. He bore all of our wrongs and all of our injustices so that we could be made right with God. So if Christ gave us that, what do you think we should give him? Well, simply everything. We need to give it all for Jesus and everything and anything we do, folks, because he gave it all for us. He gave us his life. Now, you may be wondering, how? Well, how do we do this? Well, Paul tells us in verse 11, and he says that God gave some apostles and some prophets and some evangelists and some pastors and teachers. So we have this four or five-fold ministry. Through that, we, the saints, and that's all of us who believe, are perfected for the work of the ministry. And why? For the edifying of the body of Christ. So we are equipped or perfected for the work of the ministry. And then in verse 13, he continues and said, till we all come in unity of the faith. Now, this is key here, and this is something that I didn't realize before. And this is, I think, what ties it all together. And of the knowledge of the Son of God unto a perfect man, unto the measure of the stature and the fullness of Christ. So the question we have to ask ourselves, are we there yet? Have we been perfected? No. But this word here sometimes is better translated mature. And you can mature, although you still won't be perfect until you're glorified. But we're not there yet. Right now, we certainly don't have a full knowledge and a perfected maturity. You know, we're on our process of being matured. And we can still do work as we're being perfected. And we do that work until we come into the unity of the faith. And here's where it gets really interesting, folks. Now, this unity in the world, that's like going along to get along. That's like singing kumbaya. That's like not rocking the boat. But I'm telling you, folks, that's not the same as unity in the faith. And that's where this building out of square, out of level, and out of plumb comes in. You see, unity of the faith has already been established by the apostles and the prophets through the word of God, which is Jesus. And that's unity in the faith. So we must be square, level, and plumb in all that we endeavor to build. And I think it goes beyond just the church, folks. It goes to our banking systems. But, you know, God abhors unfair weights and measures. And what's our banking system based upon? A defined measure of silver, which is defined as $1. And that's when you build your money system upon the plumb, square, and level cornerstone. But when it's not plumb, square, and level, bad things happen to your money. Same thing with education. Same thing with marriage and family. Same thing with anything you endeavor to build upon. So if we take God out of it, it gets all out of plumb. It gets all skewed. And that's the truth. All that we are by the grace of God, and then we ask him to fitly join us. Remember, Paul tells us that we are each a stone in Christ's building, the church. Now, here in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 11, that's not the first time we hear Paul talk about apostles and prophets. He mentions it back in chapter 2, verses 19 through 21, where he says, "Now, therefore, ye are no more strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and of the household of God, and are built upon the foundation of the apostles and the prophets, Jesus Christ, himself being the chief cornerstone." This is one of those verses I mentioned in the opening here. "And in whom all building fitly framed together groweth unto an holy temple of the Lord." Now, imagine that, folks. That mental image, that metaphor is so powerful, and we're part of it. And you know what's really nice is that the mortar that goes between stones, if you ever tried to stack a dry stone wall, it's very tough. But if you take a little bit of mortar and you put it between those stones, it all kinds of levels out and gets real tight. Well, that mortar, that spiritual mortar, is love. That's right, folks. And the building that we're building is the dwelling place of the very person of God, the third person in the Trinity, the Holy Spirit. And it's all built upon the cornerstone, the Lord Jesus Christ himself. So the cornerstone is the keystone. It's set the lowest, and it must be perfectly square before it's placed, and then placed perfectly level and perfectly plumb. Now, square means to be perfect 90-degree angle. So the block itself must be perfect 90, and that sets the direction of both corners of the building. And then it has to be level and plumb. Now, level refers to the top and bottom, so it has to be level that way. And this term plumb refers to the sides being level. And then when this is done, and it's perfectly aligned as the cornerstone, you can start to lay the stones of the apostles and the prophets and everything we learned out of all the other scriptures on this cornerstone. And then the building continues with you and me. Remember, we are all stones in the temple of God. So we've been set upon the cornerstones and then these keystones, the apostles and the prophets. And then he moves on to a metaphor concerning the wind, and I don't want to get into all that now. And he says in verse 14 that we henceforth be no more children tossed to and fro and carried about by every wind of doctrine, by the sleight of men and the cunning craftiness whereby they lie in wait to deceive. And isn't that what they're doing with intersectionality? Isn't that what they're doing with all these contracts that Kanye West talked about with Zionism behind it? Isn't that what they're doing with pornography? Isn't that what they're doing with the Marxist deconstruction of society today? Of the winds of doctrine in the world. And it's all over. And it's even infecting our churches today. But God says a time will come where he's going to shake it all, and only that which is built squarely, plumbly, and level is going to remain standing. And folks, that goes beyond just the church. That goes to all of our institutions, from finance to education to entertainment. They're all going to fall if they're not built square, plumb, and level. So we need to pay attention to what we're building upon and what we have already built upon. Now, Pastor Todd talked about two types of people in the world today, and he used the words progressive and conservative. Now, most of the times we tie this into politics, but it's not just politics. Bad and the other isn't good. If they're truly progressive and truly conservative in the reality of the truth, so to speak, okay? So we need both in the building of the church, in the building of any viable institution in society, be it economic, societal, educational. You remember the four pillars of truth we talked about on here? Money, politics, religion, and education. Each of those four pillars need to be square, plumb, and level. So why do you need progressives? Well, a progressive sets a direction for growth, but the direction isn't a new direction, revival, built upon the foundation of the chief cornerstone and the apostles and the prophets. Now, progress needs to be both holy and sanctified. Progress could be the revival of the family, but it must remain plumb, square, and true. And that's where the conservatives come in. So then Paul says in verse 15, but speaking the truth in love, and remember that love is the mortar that holds all of our stones fitly together so that we may grow in him, that's Jesus, in all things, which is the head, even Christ. So from the cornerstone in verse 16, we continue with from whom the whole body fitly joined together and compacted. And that's what the mortar does. That's what the love does. It holds us all together so we're not like tipping and rocking and loose, but we're all firmly tied together by love. According to the effectual working in the measure of every part, maketh increase of the body unto the edifying of itself in love. And that's what Paul's saying there. So love the truth, okay? And share the truth in love. What I'm trying to say is that you can hurt when you merely share truth, and you can hurt when you merely share love. So they have to come together, and you have to speak truth in love, and you have to speak love with truth. So if somebody's doing something stupid, they're going to mutilate their baby, you have to tell them it's wrong. But you have to do it in love. You can't attack them. And conversely, folks, if you're loving somebody and they're doing some stupid things in their life, maybe they're an alcoholic, and you're not telling them the truth about how that's destroying them, then that's no good either. So God's calling us to build the church in this unity that's been established by Jesus Christ, the apostles and the prophets, the cornerstone and the keystones of the faith, so to speak. And then he continues in verse 17 and says, this I say therefore and testify in the Lord that ye henceforth walk not as other Gentiles walk, okay, in the vanity of their minds, okay, but we need to walk in the unity of the Spirit. Folks, you can apply this to your spouse. You can apply this to your parents. If you're a child or even an adult child caring for your elderly parents, or if you're a worker with a situation at work with your boss, any of these relationships, they all need to be built upon the rock. If you're going to go out and try to reform your school system, it needs to be built upon the rock. Now think about it. If that rock, that chief cornerstone, isn't square on all corners, and you try to use that to build a square building, well, forget it. You're never going to join the corners. It's just going to, it's either going to come in or it's going to go out. If it comes in, then you're not going to have the building of the dimensions you specified, and it's not going to complete the whole square. 90 plus 90 plus 90 plus 90 equals 360. You're not going to come back and close the final. And if it goes out, if it has a corner on it that's greater than 90 degrees, you will never close the corner. Now, if it's not level, you're never going to get the roof to fit. And if it's not plumb, the walls of the building will lean, eventually fall, and then you have total failure. So the point here, which is so important, is that whatever you endeavor to embark upon, make certain that it's all built upon the chief cornerstone, Jesus Christ, who is square and has been placed by the builders level and plumb. And when you do that, good things happen. But just remember, folks, that we are called by God to occupy until he returns. That doesn't mean you go bury your head in the sand, and that doesn't mean you go out there like Kanye and act all crazy. That means that you go out there and share the truth tempered with love, and you love tempered with truth. And in all things, you never give in. You stay firm like Winston Churchill.
Never give in. Never give in. Never, never, never. In nothing, great or small, large or petty, never give in except to convictions of honor and good sense. Never yield to force. Never yield to the apparently overwhelming might of the enemy.
And remember, folks, that same spirit that rose Jesus from the grave, he lives in you and me. Let's lift our hands up with Jeremy Camp and praise the Lord.
We're living in a very defining time in our generation, where fear is creeping in and the uncertainty of the unknown is everywhere.
I can see what is raging at my feet. I can feel the breath of those surrounding me. I can hear the sound of nations rising up. We will not be overtaken. We will not be overcome. I can walk.
There's an urgency like never before in my heart to proclaim the good news of Jesus Christ, to show a world that looks like there is no hope that in Jesus alone you will find that hope and peace, to stand up in the midst of adversity and tribulation, and to show the unconditional love of our Savior while not shying away from speaking the truth of God's Word. Cry out for change in our world, but many times you are left asking, how can I make a difference? What do I do next? The truth is, we can do nothing. In our own strength and our own power, we will fail. But Jesus himself said to the disciples, I leave with you my spirit. In Romans 8:11 it says, if the spirit of him who raised Jesus from the dead dwells in you, will also give life to your mortal bodies through his spirit who dwells in you. Let's step out in his power. Let's proclaim the name of Jesus in boldness and love. And when the attacks come from all sides, walk in the understanding that greater is he that is in us than he that is in the world, because the enemy has been defeated and the victory is in Jesus. Oh,